From the studios of Absolute Broadcasting, the Radio Green Talk Radio Network presents Radio Green Talk. We're all in this together. Hosted by Diana Dean. Diana is crossing the nation and heading around the globe to bring each of you to the table to tell your story on how you have made a green difference. This is all in an effort to share information we can learn from and create a global collective for a sustainable planet. One shared idea, one solution, one conversation, and one laugh at a time. Radio Green Talk's goal is to bring awareness around the new green economy and drive improvement towards the social and environmental impact on the planet. Diana believes people are the heart of driving change, and that your innovative voices, ideas, and solutions will drive the green difference. We are turning up the volume and putting a voice behind green consumer products, green partnerships, sustainable technologies, renewable energy options, green jobs, and so much more. With a focus on our next generation, you will walk away with a better understanding of opportunities, risks, choices, and the tools for making a green difference on the planet. It's Radio Green Talk. We're all in this together. On the Radio Green Talk Radio Network and RadioGreenTalk.com with your host, Diana Dean.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Radio Green Talk. I'm Diana Dean, your host for the show. We are all in this together, and I'm honored to be here with you every Saturday and Sunday on the Radio Green Talk Radio Network and across the nation and around the globe 24/7 via podcast at RadioGreenTalk.com. Big thanks to all of you out there who are listening today, and welcome to our new listeners. I'm on a mission to head across the nation and around the world to bring each of you to the table to tell your story on how you've made a positive economic, human, or environmental difference on the planet. As you know, usually first up, we have Jurjen Kamp. He's the editor-in-chief of Ode Magazine. He's our newest Radio Green Talk partner, who normally starts us off with our weekly dose of good news happening on the planet. This week, he's traveling to Europe, so today he's unable to join us. But stay tuned next week when he's back with us with his always interesting and very thought-provoking comments. For those of you who are looking for the perfect holiday gift that lasts all year long, as a Radio Green Talk listener, you can share good news happening on the planet by sending Ode Magazine discounted subscriptions to your family and friends. It's so easy. All you have to do is go to www.odewire.com/Radio Green Talk. I'm honored to have Massachusetts Institute of Technology with us today, the MIT Climate Interactive team. They're going to be sharing some very interesting insights and climate change modeling tools. Wait till you hear what they've been working on. They're also going to give us an update on the 2011 United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP17. It concurred last week in Durban, South Africa. So why don't we get started? First off, I'd like to take a second and dedicate the show to my grandfather, Edward F. Prates. He was an MIT graduate of mathematics in the 1920s and later became a mathematics teacher at MIT in the 1940s. He was an amazing man, and he was always on a mission to bring his family together. He actually bought this old beach house in Hampton, New Hampshire in the 1940s that we still have been able to hang on to today. It's called Grandpa's Dream, and his mission was sandy feet and wet bathing suits always welcome. So thanks to him, I derived my love and passion for clean oceans, diving, and sailing. So John Sturman is the J.W. Forrester Professor of Management at the MIT Sloan School of Management, and he directs the MIT Systems Dynamics Group. Professor Sturman is an award-winning author and teacher who develops interactive management flight simulators to help students, corporations, and government policymakers understand the complex issues, particularly around climate change and sustainability. Second up, Drew Jones is co-director of the Climate Interactive, a Washington, D.C.-based think and do tank that creates policymaker-oriented simulations for top leaders in civil society. Trained in systems dynamics modeling at Dartmouth College and MIT, Jones has worked at Rocky Mountain Institute and serves dozens of clients ranging from the CDC to Harley-Davidson to the U.S. government climate change negotiators. Dr. Elizabeth Swain is the co-director of Climate Interactive, where she focuses on making Climate Interactive's insights, tools, and analysis on climate change and the transition to clean energy available to city, society, decision makers. Before founding Climate Interactive with Andrew Jones in 2010, she worked for 13 years at the Sustainability Institute, the think-do tank founded by late Dana Meadows. So listeners, if you're close to your computers, you can check out exactly what MIT is doing at www.climateinteractive.org. We need to take a quick break. I'm Diana Deem. We are Radio Green Talk. Back in a minute with the MIT Interactive team.
There's no combination of words I could put on the back of a postcard. No song that I could sing, but I can try for your heart. Our dreams, and they are made out of real things, like a shoebox of photographs with sepia tone loving. Love is the answer, at least, for most of the questions of my heart.
Welcome back to Radio Green Talk. I'm Diana Deem, and we are excited to learn from MIT's Climate Interactive team today. Why don't we go ahead and get started with John Sturman, and then move on to Drew Jones, and then to Dr. Elizabeth Sawin. Hi, John. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Ours as well. So, John, as the J. W. Forrester Professor of Management at the MIT Sloan School of Management and the director of MIT's System Dynamics Group, can you help us understand what your team actually does?
Sure. So system dynamics was developed at MIT in the 1950s, and it's an approach to help anyone, policymakers, business leaders, anyone, understand the dynamics of complex systems and take action on that greater understanding. We, as faculty at the Sloan School of Management, tend to work on issues of importance in management, including businesses, but also public policy. And in addition to developing models of complex systems, which involves computer simulation, some rather complex and elegant and beautiful mathematics, we also pay a lot of attention to working with stakeholders in the real world so that they can understand what's going on in a way that's meaningful to them and leads to action.
Mm-hmm.
So Climate Interactive was created as a consortium between our group at MIT and other folks, and Drew and Beth are the co-directors of the project, to bring that same approach to understanding one of the great challenges of our day, and that is climate change. So we've developed a set of interactive simulation models that help policymakers and other key stakeholders in business, in civil society, in the media, and education to learn about the dynamics of the climate with state-of-the-art simulations that are rigorously grounded in the best available peer-reviewed science, but that are fully documented, transparent, anybody can get the equations for any of our models, and that can run in a second or less on an ordinary laptop so that people can actually use them for policy design and for experimentation and for learning.
You know, John, it was fascinating to look at it online and sort of play with it a little bit. It's hard to describe what it looks like, if you're not sitting in front of a computer. Can you sort of go a little bit deeper into what people can expect when they look at it and what sort of outcomes they could sort of expect to learn about?
Sure. So what you'll find on the climateinteractive.org site is a set of models that are available to you. There's an online version that's freely available. You can request and download the full interactive CROADS model, Climate Rapid Overview and Decision Support Model that we've developed. And what that model will do is give you an intuitive interface through which you can put in any proposals and policies you want regarding the emissions, the greenhouse gas emissions of the United States, China, and 13 other countries and regional blocks, and then see what the impacts of those policies might be for the future climate. So, for example, you could take a look at business as usual, which is leading us on a path as a planet towards about 5 degrees Celsius or over 9 degrees Fahrenheit of warming by the year 2100, with sea level rise and ocean acidification and dramatic changes in the hydrological cycle and other impacts. And then you can go in and try any policies you want. So, for example, you can ask, what if every nation that has made a pledge under the Copenhagen Accord, now just updated and reinforced at the conference in Durban, what if they actually followed through? So you could enter those in for yourself, and then you'd see what the likely impacts would be. Oh, and you could try something more aggressive or less aggressive. What if we delay? What if we take a more aggressive stance? And in this fashion, you can see for yourself what the consequences might be. This was motivated by research that we carried out in our group at MIT showing that people really didn't understand how the climate works, despite the great work of the scientific community and the IPCC, for example, in communicating the state of the art of the science. People really don't understand how such a complex system works. Furthermore, we found that this is not something that's just about the climate. Even in ordinary, everyday contexts, people have a tough time dealing with feedback processes and time delays and accumulations and nonlinearities. And all of these characteristics of complex systems are prevalent and important in understanding the climate, as well as in understanding everyday life and other policy issues like what's happening with the debt and the deficit in the United States. So we design not only these models, but simple memes or metaphors that people can use. One of them is what we call the climate bathtub. And the idea here is very simple. People often think that if we want to stop climate change, all we need to do is stop the growth of greenhouse gas emissions. Well, that's not true. And the reason it's not true is very easy to understand. You can think of emissions as like the flow of water into your bathtub. And then nature removes some of the carbon dioxide and the other greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. The carbon dioxide is taken up by plants through photosynthesis, and it also dissolves in the ocean. But the rate at which carbon dioxide is being removed from the atmosphere is only about half the rate at which we're pumping it in. So anybody can understand that if you fill up your bathtub at a rate that's twice as fast as the water is draining out, the level of water in the tub is going to rise. Well, it turns out that while that's easy to understand, 85% of the experimental subjects that we examined in one of our studies got that wrong. So we thought there was a pressing need for simple tools and simple images like the bathtub to help people understand what's going on in the climate.
Wow, John, you just made it easy for me to even understand it. Thanks. We have a lot of students that listen to this and K through 12 classrooms picking up and listening to a lot of these shows so that they can, you know, later go back and talk about it. Can you share some additional sort of samples of how kids, our next generation, can get their arms around this and use this as a tool to really understand what the facts are with regard to climate change? There's so many non-believers of climate change out there, and the facts are so important. So if you can really help us to understand that, we'd appreciate it.
Yeah, and you're right. There are quite a lot of people, particularly in the United States, but also elsewhere in the world, who don't believe that the climate is changing or that human behavior is a significant part of the reason why. And I don't think that's something that we should blame on the public. I think the scientific community, and I include myself, we have not done a good job in making the best available science available to people in a way that people can understand. I firmly believe we can do that without dumbing it down. And in fact, a lot of our work, the simulations that we've developed, they are used in the K-12 arena. And this follows a long history in the field of system dynamics of developing curriculum material and pedagogical approaches that work effectively with K-12, including literally all the way down to kindergarten. Several of our colleagues and I have done studies of what school kids know and how they think about complex systems, and you know, they're not PhDs, but some of them are pretty good, and we find that our tools are very useful for and very well received by kids all the way down to middle school. I mean, the idea of filling your bathtub faster than it drains, causing the amount of water in the tub to rise, any kid can not only understand that, but they can do the experiment with their teacher or at home and see how that works. And then they can relate that directly to what they see in our simulations.
Absolutely. It sounds like we're borderline gaming here, aren't we?
Very much. And one of the tools we've developed is called the World Climate Role Play Simulation. And this is an interactive role play face-to-face negotiation in which the participants play the roles of the major greenhouse emitting nations, the United States, China, India, Europe, the other developed countries and the other rapidly developing countries of the world. Each person is assigned a role in one of those negotiating delegations. They're given briefing material that explains what the political constraints on them are and what their negotiating goals are. And then they negotiate in a rather realistic fashion that mimics the actual negotiations, such as the meeting that just concluded in Durban. And then, unlike the real meeting, after they've made their proposals and presented them in a short plenary speech to the other negotiators, we take their proposals and run them through our simulation model right then live in the room. And people then see what the result would be. How much is sea level going to rise, for example? And this is tremendously effective and is being picked up now by schools and universities and other groups around the world. And it's not only those. It's also been used. Drew, for example, has run it with business leaders and policymakers in Sweden and other countries. So it really works. And to make it a little more effective, we have a few aspects that help people feel the real pressures that the negotiators are under. So, for example, when the people playing the role of the rich countries come into the room, they find that their negotiating table is piled high with delicious snacks and food, while the people playing the role of the poorest nations in the world, they not only don't have any on their table, but I make them sit on the floor. Now, this is a very simple manipulation intervention, but it creates real emotions in the room, similar to the real emotions that you saw at play in Durban. And then when sea level rises, well, we get out a big blue tarpaulin and we cover people up to indicate that, yeah, their homes have been flooded and they now have to migrate to some other country. All of a sudden, the participants begin to understand that this isn't just a zero-sum game where if one country wins, the others must lose, but rather we're all in the same boat and have a joint collective interest in reaching an agreement.
John, that is
it's just tremendously fun. And all the information, all the supplies to do this are freely available to anyone from the climateinteractive.org website.
John, this is so cool. It's a real hands-on experience for climate change. I didn't realize, I knew looking at the website that you know, you could start to figure out and ask these questions, but I didn't know you were making it a real dynamic personal experience like that. Wow. Have you considered pulling?
Well, that's the way people learn. It's much more effective when you actually do it for yourself.
It would be absolutely fascinating to pull people, you know, maybe government, corporation, kids, entrepreneurs, you know, artists together in a room to do something like this. Have you done it?
So yes, we have, and Drew's actually done this perhaps more than I have. So Drew, what do you think?
Yeah, it's this is the way that we're going to engage people at a much deeper level. You know, you can imagine, you hear us talking about these simulations. You have this image of, many people have an image of like eighth grade math class. You know, here's the x-axis and here's the y-axis, blah, blah, blah. But what John's describing is the way that people engage at a visceral, physical level in actually understanding what's going on and believing the truth of the matter, which we can actually do something about this and create a world where we do have a stable climate over the long term. And by pulling real citizens together or real policymakers from kindergarten up to president CEO level, we find that these kind of interactive settings are the way that people really get it. And I don't know, just the drama of it, I've seen the situations where those people on the floor are quickly not on the floor. They're barring the door. They're like, we're the Africans. We're making sure no one's leaving until we have a deal. And pretty quickly, people are standing on chairs, screaming at each other, just like what happened last week in Durban. Well, they're not screaming at each other, but then you have people set up like those students who were so vocal in Durban last week, interrupting the proceedings, like just saying, no, I'm taking the floor over. Here's what I need to say to the world, and creating that kind of drama that makes all of the math that's so necessary. People need to engage with these simulations for us to understand things, but if you just do it how we've always done it, no one listens. So that's really the innovations that our team, and this really goes back 50 years of research at MIT, trying to make these important insights into complex systems. I mean, but you say that, insights into complex systems, no one wants to hear that. But when it's people screaming at each other on chairs and then really understanding how to create the world they've always dreamed of, that really works. So we're trying to find different ways to do it. The latest is the Climate Pathways app on the iPhone. Diana, did you read about that one yet?
Tell the listeners. I did read about it, but tell the listeners.
Yeah, so the world's first climate simulation model is now on a mobile device. It's called Climate Pathways. It's at the App Store for the iPhone and the iPad, and we compressed it down so that anybody could go and run a little climate model, and it has a very simple lesson. The point is, like, trying to bring these important insights to people, to leaders, to a broad range of folks in formats and in forms that really touch people's minds as well as their hearts, and give this main message that we can actually do this. We can create the world that we really want if we're really thoughtful about it and if we can diffuse these ideas broadly and fast enough and be smart about it.
You know, Drew, you couldn't have put it better. Really getting our hands dirty and experiencing it, it sounds just like an amazing, you know, fascinating process. It's interesting, both Drew and John, a couple of weeks ago, we had Al Gore's CEO, Maggie Fox, on, and she's leading the Climate Reality Project. And one of the things that surprised me in my thinking was, how do we take this education now and we know what's going on with climate change. Got that, understand it. Next step, though, is how do we make it a real life experience like you guys are doing, which just blows my mind and fascinates me, gets me so excited. But then how do we, once we get that hands-on experience, how do we answer the question, what's in it for each of us? And I'd like to know that perspective from both of you, and then also from Elizabeth as well. John, would you mind sort of talking about that, and then Drew?
Sure. So connecting what people learn about what's happening in the climate and what are global emissions and how the temperature continues to rise, even if emissions begin to fall because we haven't balanced that bathtub. These are big global ideas that people should understand. But then the challenge is, just as you said, how do we connect those big lessons that because of the time delays, it's urgent that we begin to reduce emissions if we are serious about limiting warming to the 2 degrees C goal that's been articulated and adopted by all the nations of the world. And let me just say, it's not our job as scientists to tell people what they want, what their policy goals are. That's not the job of scientists. Our job is to give people analytical tools so that given their goals, such as the goal that all the nations of the world have adopted to limit warming to no more than 2 degrees C, given those goals, how can we create policies that actually have a shot of achieving them? And so there's a pressing need to connect those big macro lessons to what you can do as an individual. And we've developed a variety of tools to help with that. The work that Maggie Fox and Vice President Gore are doing is quite important and is one of a number of organizations out there helping with that. But our view is we need to remain, and we are, nonpartisan, nonprofit, telling it like it is in terms of the science, but creating those opportunities for people to ask the question, well, what can I do as an individual? And that usually does come up in the conversations. And then our job is just to facilitate. It's not to tell them what they can do or what they ought to do, but to hear from others. What we found is so interesting is there's a tremendous pool of expertise and experience and insight in any audience we work with about what you can do as an individual. Sometimes it's businesses getting together and saying, we're going to increase the aggressiveness of our corporate targets for our emissions reductions, and here's how we're going to measure that and hold ourselves accountable. Sometimes it's school kids saying, you know, I went home, I talked to my parents, and we got rid of all our incandescent bulbs and put in more efficient lighting, and I'm going to take, I'm going to cut back on my video games or whatever it might be. And then we help people understand how that can add up to meaningful action.
It's fascinating to hear you say that. The other part of this, I think, John, that's so important is helping it, if we take this a little personal, okay? For me, the reason why, I put together this whole Radio Green Talk show was to educate and drive the opportunities for each of us with regard to what we can create to positively impact and say, for example, lower our reliance on fossil fuels or impact the planet from a standpoint of lowering GHGs. What I struggle with personally, and Drew, here's the question for you, is how do we as individuals look into the future and think about how this impacts us? For me, it's my 8, 10, and 12-year-old nieces. I think about the lives that they have ahead of them. What is it for you, Drew? We got about 5 minutes left, and then we're going to take a break and come back with Elizabeth. But can you help us fill that 5 minutes?
Yeah, I think, for me, it's, and particularly as a person working in this field, it's finding the things that are meaningful to me and looking and watching other people. I mean, John's talking very abstractly, but I've also been in his office as he, takes off his biking gear because he biked from Arlington, all the way outside of Boston into the T to take the subway into MIT, or send around these pictures of him like carrying a Christmas tree on his back on his skis. This is a guy who leads groups of students through the old building, and what was it, caulk your talk, John? Did you call it that? Caulking around the windows. And there's no fixed answer of how it's done. It's like for each of us, what's going to fuel us is what's meaningful individually, and there's no recipe of what it's got to be. Those are the things that I've seen John do. Get Elizabeth talking about, growing your own food and all the things she's done in this incredible co-housing place that she lives up in Vermont. For me, I look at the carbon footprint of my house. I totally geek out on the numbers, and I've tracked really about a 60% drop in the carbon footprint of just my house with insulation and better windows and solar panels, and tracking that every year to see what is my carbon footprint. If I measure it, then I'm going to do something about it. So I think it's for all of us to find the thing that we find meaningful at the same time that we're working at a much higher level of system change, because we know it's just not enough to do these individual things. It's a kind of a both and. That's what I'm finding.
And walking our talk is I think a critical part of this. So Drew has retrofitted his house. I bicycle to work, compost all our food waste. I've cut the carbon footprint of our house in half by insulation and better windows and a high efficiency boiler. And we're now doing a deep energy retrofit. And the important point about this is, I saved money doing that. These things made money for our household because we cut the expenses associated with heating and operating the house. And it was incredibly fun to do. So, a lot of the environmental rhetoric out there is doom and gloom and despair. And we just totally reject that. There's so much opportunity. And when you understand what's going on out there, for example, using the simulations that we've developed to help you do that, it's so empowering because now you've got a deep understanding of how you're going to get from where we are today to wherever it is you personally want to go.
Exactly. Exactly. And like you said, John, we can make money at this. I did the same thing with my home and was able to cut the electric bill, for example, in half within just 3 months. So there's a lot of money to be saved. Yeah. And now I'm having a lot of fun looking at reinvestment into solar. So I'm not there yet, but what an exciting time. We're talking to businesses as well that are sort of doing these little self audits, whether they're a corporation or on our own, and saying, oh my goodness, there's some low hanging fruit here to be, money to be saved. And then do I reinvest that in a new hybrid car, or do I reinvest that in some sort of renewable energy applications? It's really so much fun. All right, we got to take a really quick break. I'm Diana Deem, and we are excited to be speaking with MIT's Climate Interactive team today on Radio Green Talk. Back in a minute. From MIT's Climate Interactive team, John Sturman, Drew Jones, and Dr. Elizabeth Sawin. Elizabeth, we're back to you. Welcome to the show. We've been having such an inspirational, exciting conversation. Can you tell us what the Climate Scoreboard is all about?
Yeah, I'm glad to. We created the Climate Scoreboard, which your listeners could take a look at climatescoreboard.org, back in 2009. This was just before the Copenhagen Climate Talks. And we found out, and we were just really astounded by this fact, that really neither the delegates to the talks, the representatives of different governments, nor the ordinary citizens who were following the talks were able to answer this critical question. So countries were making proposals for how much they felt they could reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. But because each country was describing their proposals in slightly different terms, there wasn't really a way to add all the proposals up. And then on top of that, because of the complexities of the climate bathtub that John was talking about earlier, it wasn't really possible for people to know what it would mean if those pledges were implemented for the long-term well-being of the climate. And that's the future perspective that you were talking about earlier, Diana, of really needing to look at the long-term on an issue like climate change. And frankly, we just thought that was crazy. How could the world's leaders have this enormous responsibility to limit dangerous human interference with the climate and not be able to tell if they were on track to meet that goal? We used to joke that it was like all the world's countries had just had this huge party in a bar, and the waitress had shown up with the bill, which is how much they needed to reduce their emissions. And countries started digging around in their pockets and putting money on the table, you know, some dollars here, some pesos there, a few yen, and nobody knew what the exchange rates were, and nobody had a calculator to see if they were even close to covering the tab. The Climate Scoreboard was basically our answer to that crazy situation. We found a way to add up the pledges, and we used our climate simulations to play out those consequences of the pledges for temperature increase. And what we found was that while the pledges that countries were putting on the table were an improvement over business as usual, they didn't meet that goal of preventing dangerous long-term climate change. Scientists have urged that we limit temperature increase to something between 2.7 and 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit over their pre-industrial temperatures. Without any action, John mentioned earlier, that's projected to be close to 9 degrees Fahrenheit of warming. And we found that the pledges were better than 9 degrees, more like 7.7 degrees Fahrenheit, but a far cry from the 2.7 to 3.6 degrees. So there was some improvement, but there was much further to go. And so in the time period before Copenhagen, we shared this finding in the standard way that scientists do. We wrote papers, we presented at conferences, but we also wanted the civil society groups who were following the talks to have this information. So the Climate Scoreboard was our way of sharing that information in a different form than the typical scientific paper. It was an online embeddable widget. People could put it on their blogs or their Facebook pages and track the progress of the pledges as they changed in Copenhagen. And we've been keeping the scoreboard up to date ever since through the most recent talks in Durban.
That's pretty exciting stuff. I love it how you bring it back to like a real life situation as well. So what did you learn from so far? You know, I know the Durban talks just finished, but what have you guys learned with regard to the climate scoreboard for the Durban talks or COP17?
Well, the first thing that we learned, is about the importance of sharing this kind of information. So our hypothesis was that we would get a better result for the world if scientists were able to provide real-time feedback on how the negotiations were going. And it's important to note that it's not just our group. There are half a dozen different scientific groups around the world doing the same sort of thing. One exciting result in Durban was actually now embedded in the negotiating text is a recognition of this gap between where emissions need to be and where they actually are. And the official recognition in this now international legal document basically uses the language of these scientific groups to note that there's a gap and to express a commitment to do something about it. That's, of course, a big job, and it will take a lot of political will, but that's big progress from the pre-Copenhagen days when no one knew whether there was a gap or how big it was to actually including in the official documents a recognition of that gap. Unfortunately, the size of the gap hasn't shrunk since Copenhagen. So that's the bad news, and really where all of us need to focus our efforts is on closing that gap and reducing the strength, increasing the strength of the pledges.
Elizabeth, you just read my mind. That's exactly what I was going to ask you about. That and who have you sort of shared the most recent updates with, and what kind of feedback are you receiving?
We tend to share our results with three groups. So the first are the negotiators themselves, and that's through briefing documents and presentations and press releases. The second important group are journalists who are reporting to people around the world about the progress of the talks. So our work helps the journalists understand the insufficiency of the pledge and pledges and communicate that to their readers. And we go to great lengths to make sure that all of our data is freely available on our website. So journalists are able to do things like take our analysis and create their own graphics in whatever language they're reporting in for their readers. And then the third group is civil society groups. And we have a growing network of leaders in different advocacy groups, people who are holding the whole process accountable, really, who are following our analysis and using it in their pressure that they're applying to the negotiations. One of my favorite examples of that was in Copenhagen, when some of the folks in the Global Climate Action Organization 350.org downloaded these graphs that I was just speaking about, and they printed hundreds of copies in bright orange and pasted them up all around the conference center where the delegates were meeting and handed the graphics out as flyers as delegates came into the negotiating room that day, really saying, here's the latest scientific analysis, we need to do more. So we're a team, relatively small team of a dozen or so people, and so our efforts can be amplified when journalists and civil society leaders can take our results and do good work with them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's interesting. Last week, we had Admiral Len Herring from the U.S. Navy. He's now since retired a year ago and working with the University of California, San Diego. And one of his biggest challenges and what he was struggling with is the infrastructure for policy behind this. And I'd love to hear your recommendations and solutions for driving this forward across the nation and then also with the impact of COP17. There's that gap there. I'd like to ask yourself and then Drew and then also John, what your vision is around the solution for driving policy, say, you know, for climate change.
Well, one of the good news stories coming out of COP17 is that the delegates were able to preserve this international architecture for discussing and eventually agreeing to significant and sufficient reductions in emissions. So the good news is that there's sort of a blank document waiting to be filled in and waiting to be agreed by all the countries of the world. The bad news, or the where there's more work yet needed, is filling in those blanks. So in Copenhagen and then the year after in Cancun and now just last week in Durban, so far, the world's governments haven't been able to agree to sufficient reductions. Where that comes back to is the political climate at home in each of the countries that's a major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, including the U.S. And where that points to me is the need for grassroots political organizing to really express the message to our political leaders around the world that they need to do better, that they need to up the ambition of this process. Just before Durban, a study came out of a survey in the United States from the Yale Project on climate change communication, and they found that 66% of Americans supported the U.S. signing an international treaty to cut emissions 90% by 2050. Yet in Durban, the U.S. negotiators acted as though they didn't have the support of the American people to make significant pledges. And I think that's the gap that we have to close between what the American people actually want and what the elected leaders seem to be assuming. I think that comes down to straight-on political organizing.
Good point. Good point. So that being said, we say we get the organizing, fully in place. I love turning these concepts on their head. And Drew, I'd love to bounce this question off of you. If we turn this on its head and we get back at, you know, what's in it for us as individuals to get on board for climate change? And again, this is the question posed to the CEO Maggie Fox of Al Gore's Climate Reality Project. She came back with a really interesting answer. How does the nation make money, and how do we send people back to work and turn this budget around by supporting and looking at the opportunities with regard to climate change? Drew, do you have any comments for that?
Yeah, I think that the most exciting thing that's going on right now in that area is this energy transition, where there's such a huge opportunity, as John was talking about earlier, at the kind of residential and business level, but just at the overall industry and economy level, in all these opportunities in green energy, in solar energy, which is growing so quickly, in energy efficiency, and other things that are the solutions to climate change that are growing so fast right now. And I know, John, a lot of your research, your PhD in 1983 was really about this energy transition. I might pass it over to you because you've thought so much more about some of the specifics of the way that businesses can be part of this and industry. What comes on to you?
Well, so there's a trope out there that if we cut our greenhouse gas emissions, it's going to be harmful to the economy. And there's no doubt that some of the things that might be needed are going to have certain adjustment costs, temporary adjustment costs associated with them. Most scientific groups, most modeling groups that look at this conclude that those costs are small and less than the costs of delay and the harm that climate change will generate. But it turns out when you look at those costs in more detail, there's also at the same time tremendous opportunity to cut our energy use, to cut our dependence on imported oil, to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions in a way that actually makes money and creates jobs here in the United States. For example, there's many studies that show that existing technologies that are ready to go off the shelf today to improve the end-use efficiency of energy consumption in residential, commercial, industrial contexts, and in transportation are simply not being adopted just on the business case. So forget that they have environmental benefits. If you are a smart business person wanting to maximize your profits, you would implement these technologies because you save more, even on a net present value basis, by doing it than it costs you to do. That's just good business sense. And there's, by varying estimates, as many as 12 gigatons per year, 12 billion tons per year of carbon dioxide equivalent emissions that could be mitigated, eliminated every year by implementing the technologies that make money for us today. So the research question isn't just how do we create new technologies, and we do need to do that, of course, but it's how is it that we implement the things that we know about already today and that are economically attractive today. And I can tell you this is more a question of economics, but especially organizational change, psychology, even culture and political science, than it is a question of climatology or engineering. For example, here on the campus at MIT, we have a committee that I sit on along with many other faculty, senior administrators, and our senior heads of facilities and all the other administrative functions that we call the Walk the Talk Committee. And our job is to improve the campus experience while reducing our costs and lowering our environmental impact. the facilities folks, did a project with one of our major buildings, a recently built structure dating from 1995. And what we did is we went in there and we maintained all the equipment up to modern standards. We cleaned out the air handling equipment and the ducts, lubricated all the equipment, and we tuned up the sensors and controls, which hadn't really been done. And so they drifted. And without anybody noticing, the building was simultaneously pulling steam to heat itself and chilled water to cool itself, all at the very same time. And this resulted in tremendous expense. So the project cost about $150,000 to do, and it saved in the first year alone $400,000 in energy costs. That's a pretty good payback time. I'll take that any day. In fact, I'm fond of telling our senior administration that that project yielded a far higher return on investment than we earn on our endowment. And so now what's happening is we're increasing our investment in that kind of activity all across the campus, making money for the Institute, increasing our ability to invest in education and research for the benefit of our students, our alumni, the businesses we work with, and the world, and getting the students involved as well. Drew mentioned the caulking project that I did in one of our old buildings. We just went through there, and in one afternoon with a few students, a couple alums, and our dean, who was an enthusiastic participant, and folks from facilities, we caulked all the windows in the building, had a terrific time doing it, probably saved $10,000 to $15,000 a year in energy costs. There's so much opportunity all over the country for that, and the jobs that it'll create, they're here, and they can benefit our people right now today.
So, John, I really have to compliment you on what an amazing team you have there. And it's a lot of fun talking with all three of you. For listeners, I want to make sure that you understand where you can gather more information. It's climateinteractive.org. And, John, are there other websites that they should go to? I know Elizabeth mentioned the climate scorecard as well.
Right. Climatescoreboard.org, climateinteractive.org. You can go to my website at MIT, jsterman, jsterman.scripps.mit.edu. You can also go to the mitsloan.mit.edu website and learn about the sustainability initiative at the MIT Sloan School of Management, our educational program, our research programs, there's a host of other resources out there. From the climateinteractive.org site, folks will be able to access the online simulation, CLEARN, and request the full simulation model, C-ROADS, and access all the world climate materials. And all of that is freely available.
That's exciting. That is so nice to know that that's even there, John. I want to take a different tack for a second, and I want to get back to sort of the heart of why the three of you do what you do. And John, if we could start with you, what, as a kid, can you remember a moment in time when you realized that this was something, you know, sustainability was something you really wanted to learn more about?
I remember it very clearly. I was in high school, and my father brought home one of the articles Jay Forrester had written about these issues, and I devoured it, began to learn about system dynamics and modeling these issues, and then by chance, I happened to go to Dartmouth College for undergraduate education, and I went there because I loved skiing. And while I was there, just by chance, I found out that two of the people from Jay's group at MIT had just joined the faculty there, Dennis Meadows and Dana Meadows. And I changed my major from what was going to be physics and started doing this kind of work. And it's one of those serendipitous, unplannable events that dramatically shapes your life and your career. Mm-hmm. Dana was a wonderful teacher and scholar. She passed away in 2001, but she was an award-winning journalist, not only doing world-class research, but getting the word out to the public. And that combination of citizen scholar, I think, really has had an impact on how I think Drew and Beth and the others on our team, how we approach these issues.
What an amazing legacy she left us, isn't it? Drew, do you remember your first moment in time that shifted your thinking towards sustainability?
It's funny, Dana Meadows was part of that. It turns, you know, Beth and I were both students of hers and colleagues eventually at Sustainability Institute, the nonprofit she founded. And my kind of cathartic moment was with her when I was a student at Dartmouth College and a student activist on campus and organized 140 people to carry around our trash for a week. On our backs, clear plastic bags, pizza boxes, beer bottles, everything go in there and carry to the gym and to class and to the dorm room. And it was my first experience with the power of simulation. So all that stuff we were talking about world climate and the iPhone app, all these things are, in my mind, in pursuit of, can we create an experience as powerful as living in a world for a week where there's no away, where the long-term delayed actions that you take or the implications of your actions are visceral, real, and now. Because I saw 150 people change their paradigm really fast. And so all of these computer models are really a pursuit of that, the beauty and power of that experiment that happened 20 years ago.
Wow. Talk about literally get our hands dirty. How big was your pack of trash on your back?
Very dirty.
Elizabeth, can you tell us your first moment of sustainability as well? We've got about a minute left, unfortunately. I could go on for an entire day with you three. This is so much fun.
Well, maybe I'll just add to that picture of Dinella Meadows because she did influence John, Andrew, and me. The other side of what she did was enable people to picture a vision of the world that they wanted to see. And I live in that vision to some extent because I live in a eco-village that Dinella Meadows helped found over 10 years ago, where 20 families share a farm and housing and buildings and the stewardship of a lot of land in a very sustainable and very fun experiment. And so there's that as well as the whole analytics side that Dinella Meadows was so strong in. It's just that encouragement to go for it and live in the world that you want to see, and that's how that world gets created.
Elizabeth, you couldn't have put it better. It's true. We all really need to walk our talk. And it's funny, on my desk, I have a thing that says the best way to predict the future is to create it. So it sounds to me like all of us are on the same page today. I can't wait to have you back. Thanks for taking the time today for joining us on Radio Green Talk, and have a great afternoon. Thank you all very much.
Our pleasure.
I'm Diana Deem. We are Radio Green Talk. Special thanks to our amazing guests today from the MIT Climate Interactive team and to our many past guests making a difference on the planet. Patagonia, the Global Conscious Leadership Institute, the U.S. Marine Corps, CEO Jeff Sterba of American Water, Ed Begley Jr. and his wife, Rochelle Carson Begley, USA Green Stories, Maggie Fox, CEO of Al Gore's Climate Reality Project, USGSA, Portland Fashion Week, Oregon Solar Highway, US EPA, Alec Lores with the I Matter March, Starbucks, Hewlett-Packard, BASF, Ford, Stonyfield Farm Yogurt, Heifer International, California EPA, California EEI, Idea Festival. You can listen to all of these amazing guests by going to Facebook at RadioGreenTalk.com or RadioGreenTalk.com's podcast page. Be a part of sustainability education and solutions on the planet. Get your social responsibility message out here by emailing Julie at RadioGreenTalk.com. Your help keeps us on the air and keeps these vital programs alive, so thank you in advance. Find us on the web at Radio Green Talk and on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks, everybody. We are all in this together. Join us next week, and remember to talk Radio Green Talk.